of that bread. Forks made in the house of the past that leads down to the dead. She said,
another Saturday, another attempt to combat the confused culture we live in using the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of King Solomon. Yes, this is Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. If you want to join in on the discussion today, and you may want to, all you have to do is call in after the first commercial break. Number's 520-750-7456. And if you can't stay by your radio, you can always stream us live from powertalk1210.com. Or if you've missed a show and want to hear one again, go to SolomonOnBlast.com and you can listen at your convenience. As I was preparing for today's show, I was thinking about the reason we do this show. And that actually got me to thinking about reason itself. Let's call it the reason for reason, which got me to thinking, is there any reason left in our culture? Preparing for this show, I came across a lot of news articles, blogs, websites that obviously indicate just how confused people are, people that no longer seem to want to be able to reason or can reason. Why is that? My first thought, because of lack of wisdom. No wisdom, no reason. Makes sense. But Solomon has another reason for the lack of reason. He says in Ecclesiastes 7:7, surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. So according to Solomon, oppression is something that destroys reason, even the reason of a wise man. Just like a bribe destroys a person's ability to make moral decisions. With the lack of reason as prevalent as it seems to be, oppression is probably not the only cause of our culture's lack of reason. But if oppression is a reason for the lack of reason, where's that oppression coming from? Is it oppression from the government? Maybe that would account for the fact that the lack of reason in our culture is so diverse. Lack of reason doesn't seem to discriminate. With the government making sure there's equality in everything, then maybe it's making sure it's oppression and therefore its lack of reason is equitable. But I think a big part of the oppression is really from fear. And I think a lot of it has to do with our culture, where feelings and emotion have taken the place of logic. And when emotions prevail, reason's lost, especially when it's the emotion of fear. Anyone can be susceptible to it. As an example, I was out hunting with a good friend of mine who I consider to be one of those guys, you know, you can count on when needed. He's always got your back in a crisis. We were out dove hunting, and we'd gone off separate directions, and while I was alone, I almost stepped on a rattlesnake. So as I have an affinity to those things when I'm hunting, I shot the snake's head off, and I threw it in the back of my hunting vest in the pouch. And then a little while later, I heard him shoot. And so I headed over in his direction, knowing at that point that he didn't have his vest with him, and he probably needed to be able to put the bird that he shot in the vest. So when he got close, sure enough, he had a dove. And when we got close to each other, I offered to put the dove that he had shot in my vest pouch. And, you know, I'm a considerate friend. And as he walked over, I reached around and opened the pocket so he could put the bird in himself. And as he did, he reached to put the bird in, he saw the snake. Well, he jumped back about 3 feet, and he then asked me the question that I never would have thought would have come out of his mouth. He asked me, is it dead? And I said, you got to be kidding. You know, I wouldn't put a live snake in the back of my hunting vest. But what I realized, he was asking based on fear. It was an emotional response. You know, the oppression from his fear of the snake completely oppressed his ability to reason that I would even consider putting a live snake in my vest. And that's a lot of our culture today. It's a lot of what the news is. The news stories get selected because they're tragedies, they're unique, they're designed to elicit an emotional response and draw in viewers. That brings in the advertisers. Hence the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. And the public education system, not really much different. It teaches emotion now more than reason. Isn't that the whole approach to climate change and global warming, the fear of the demise of the planet? That fear oppresses the ability to reason. And to paraphrase a famous quote, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the culture in the next. That's what we're seeing. So instead of allowing fear and emotions to make our decisions, we need to use reason. And as always, Solomon says it best. Ecclesiastes 7:25, he says, I applied my heart to know, to search and seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. So bringing it back around to where I started, that's the reason we do the show. And it's going to be an interesting show. We'll come back after these commercial messages.
Well, you drink champagne and it tastes like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A, Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a thumbprint voice she said hello.
Here on Power Talk 1210 today. Proverbs 22:14, Solomon says, the mouth of an immoral woman is a deep pit. He who is abhorred by the Lord will fall there. Well, I wonder if that's really where the source of what we're going to talk about here next. Now, we discussed this a little bit. It's a difficult topic to bring up and really talk about, but you have to reason through things. And I think part of what I've said at the beginning is that that reason doesn't exist, and most things that people do are in response to emotion than anything else.
Yeah, I have to confess, Doug, that when you first brought this up, I even asked you, why do we really want to talk about this? But as you explained to me where you were coming from this morning, and that today people are afraid to think about certain things, that really made me reconsider the idea that, yeah, there are thoughts that we have. And I think it was David Horowitz from frontpagemag.com who said, you know, a hate crime is really a thought crime. That what happens with people is they get intimidated to the point where they don't even want to think about things anymore because they're afraid they might say something after coming to a certain conclusion. So they just completely put off the idea, and they won't even consider it. They won't even reflect on it anymore. And it's really an interesting psychological observation, but I think it's true.
Yeah. And so what are we talking about? Well, the biggest story in the news this past week, Bruce Jenner becoming Caitlyn Jenner, and more along the lines of Caitlyn Jenner to receive the Arthur Ashe Courage Award, according to this article from Huffington Post. Says ESPN will honor Caitlyn Jenner with the Arthur Ashe Courage Award at the 2015 ESPY Awards, according to CNN. Arthur Ashe Award is given to those possessing strength in the face of adversity, courage in the face of peril, and willingness to stand up for their beliefs no matter what the cost, according to ESPN.com. Past winners include last year Michael Sam, Muhammad Ali, Pat Tillman, Nelson Mandela, and Billie Jean King from way back. So, says Jenner, who previously went by the name of Bruce, as we all know, came out as a transgender in a sit-down interview with ABC's Diane Sawyer back in April. And on Monday, she's now rolled out in the cover of Vanity Fair. So this is a sensitive topic, but I have.
Well, and this is fair game.
It is.
We have to ask ourselves, is this a great act of courage? I mean, it's a fair question.
That's exactly where I was going. Is this really courage? I don't think so. Because not everybody's going to be able to do and solve their problem if they have this same issue of being transgender the way Bruce Jenner could. He had the money to pay for the procedure. Most people don't.
Well, if you're a prisoner in the California State Penitentiary, you've got money to do it too.
Yeah, the taxpayers will pay for it in that situation. But most people don't. He has money to pay for the hormone therapy that she'll have to do for the rest of her life.
To make sure the whiskers don't come back.
Right. And he created a lot of attention for himself beforehand, like I said, went on Diane Sawyer, and she's creating a lot of attention for herself now. So financially, it's not going to be an impact, probably a positive. And so where is really the courage in that? Courage is usually something that happens behind the scenes that people don't
see. I just want to throw this out. She got another shout-out from Obama, another shout-out.
Oh, you know, really?
For the courage, yeah.
So is it really courage? And how does that really reflect when there's a lot of other people that do things that I guess you could easily consider to be much more courageous? Was there any reasoning behind the people that make these selections for this award other than lots of publicity?
Now, I'd say I think a courage assumption is that, like in any situation where we would say someone had courage, it has to do with somehow saving a life. And I think their assumption here is that by Bruce becoming Caitlin, he saved his true self. You know, he somehow stepped up and defended the person that was really in there, as opposed to just going along with his birth nature.
Hmm. I honestly got to thinking about it. And, you know, was it really more along the lines of Bruce Jenner just wasn't getting the attention that his wife was and all the girls were?
In other words, did the competition with the Kardashians finally wear him down?
Yeah, if you can't beat him, you join him kind of attitude. I don't know. It just...
I
go back to...
Who knows, but he definitely... he's not going to win that decathlon. That's all I'm going to say.
No. And really, is there going to be... What is he looking for, or what is she looking for now in terms of happiness or a satisfying life?
Well, here's the way I see the question, because, again, I got fascinated by your position here. Do we have the right to think about this and talk about this and reason through this? And so when I think about it, Doug, I'm thinking about the bigger question of the whole transgender experience in general. And, you know... I have to admit, I'm a little bit dubious about this. And for a lot of reasons, you can say it's just my position, my personal prejudices. Say what you want. But the way I view the whole transgender fascination is the same way I view reincarnation. And here's what I mean.
Okay.
You know, when someone claims to be reincarnated, they're always Napoleon. They're never the peasant soldier that changes his bedpan. You know what I mean? Historical figure you learned about when you were in history. So in reality, reincarnation is really telling you who the people heard about, who they were fascinated with, and then they somehow project themselves into that story.
Right. And I had the same thought always about reincarnation. Why weren't there ever peasants reincarnated?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I was the lowly guy that had to clean out the stalls.
It's always King Henry VIII. Right. You know?
Yeah.
And so the other point, here's what the way I'm comparing this to the whole transgender fascination. You know, Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn, is just not a typical woman. Caitlyn is, you know, a 65-year-old man becomes a 40-year-old woman on the cover of Vanity Fair, a model. You know, you think about this for a second. It's almost like the classic male sexist view of a woman. He didn't just become any woman.
He became
a woman that man would have said, that's interesting.
Right.
So, I don't know. I'm very...
And everything else.
Exactly.
Right?
I think it's a class... I think he's making a... In other words, if a man were to become a woman, this is like a classic male sexist way to do it.
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
My question, really, what do women think about this aspect of it? You know, are they in support of it because, you know, he's a strong person or whatever? Or is it, you're invading my territory? Because I think there's a lot of that. Now, one of the things that I got to thinking about was, this has all happened before. It's nothing new, and as Solomon always says, there's nothing new under the sun. Go back to 1975, and somebody by the name of Renee Richards, Dr. Renee Richards,
Yeah, I remember.
Right? And so had a sex change operation and went on the professional tennis tour, got a decision that I think it was by the Supreme Court that allowed her to play as a woman on the women's tennis tour. And there was a lot of publicity, a lot of stuff coming out that said, oh, you know, this is really going to be a turning point for the transgender community. 40 years later, it's happening again. What happened between those two time periods? Was there really a transition or a improvement from the transgender community?
Well, I'll try to answer that. I'd say 40 years ago, you still had people who were taught to criticize these things and were able to discuss these things amongst themselves openly. So if there's going to be a difference today, is what you, again, the same point you started with. And that is people today are afraid to think through these things because they're afraid of the conclusions they may come to and the things they might say about the conclusions they've come to. And so they're it's not the same. I don't think it's the same. I think it's we're in a day where it's not people are thinking through things, where people are see no evil, you know,
right,
hear no evil.
Right. The and oppression just, causes you not to reason, and that oppression
another
is from
thing
the
from
fear.
The 70s, Sergeant Schultz, you know, I know nothing.
Oh, right.
I know nothing, and that's the way people go through life now. They refuse to, you know, acknowledge. I just mind my own business. And that's the way a lot of this advances, because people do not want to look bad. And there's an intimidation factor. And even though everybody says inside themselves, this is nuts, you can't say that anymore.
Right.
Because everything is not just, you know, it's not just homophobic thoughts and you know, narrow-minded worldview that makes you think that way. You're talking about everything you honestly think about the universe inside of you reacts to it, and you can't help it. But you can't even, you can't be who you are anymore.
No. And
Bruce can be who he says he is, yes, but we nobody can, else can.
Nobody else know? Can, right. Nobody can
trouble.
Be realistic about what they believe. And part of that thought process, reasoning about this, was if Bruce was really looking for the opportunity to be a woman, is she looking for the opportunity to be a woman by having a man in her life? And honestly, would anybody that...
Now, this is what makes the story really crazy, is that Bruce says, I guess he says he's still into women. So before he had the, I don't even know, is he post-op? I'm not even sure how far this has gone. But before he's made the transformation,
uh-huh,
I guess he made it pretty clear he was still attracted to women. So and that he was not gay, but I guess now that he's a woman, he has to be. I mean, I don't know. Somewhere there's going to have to be a whole panel to...
Well, that's my question. Is he looking to be a woman as a woman?
Yeah.
Or is he looking to be the...
Now I'm more confused than Bruce.
The homosexual side of a woman. Because I guess one of his original or his first tweet or one of the tweets that he sent out, that she sent out, after this award was given, was what dress am I going to wear? So I guess from that aspect, you know, that's the significant part about this whole thing, is making sure you look right out in the public. Is it really?
But again, I go back to that classic sexist male view of a woman. What woman is interesting to me, you know, and a woman on the cover of Vanity Fair. Yeah, you know, that's how men think.
Right.
And so I think Bruce is thinking very much like a man. I don't think he's going to get that part of his anatomy altered at all.
One of the things that I read about with regards to Renee Richards, Dr. Renee Richards, one thing that she said was she wished that she hadn't really pursued the fame part of the whole thing. Because at that point, she did it a lot younger age. She was looking for some kind of relationship, and in her life, her son, which she had before she had the change, was really the only person in her life that continued she continued contact with her wife before she was changed. Wouldn't have anything to do with her. Her mother wouldn't have anything to do with her. Wouldn't talk to her. And so she really wishes that she didn't have all the fame, because whenever she came upon somebody that she thought she might be able to have some kind of connection with, once they knew who she was, no way, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it goes along those lines. What is Caitlin really looking for? And is it going to solve any of the problems deep in that person's heart?
Now, there's one angle that we haven't even talked about yet, and that is, before all of this, Bruce Jenner was involved in a car accident where somebody was killed. And I think all that is pending, right?
Yeah.
They could be real jail time. So
yeah.
Maybe this is just about when the cops come looking for Bruce.
They can't
find him. His sister Caitlin doesn't know where he is, you know? So that could be part of the ruse as well.
Yeah. And the other aspect of it is, why now, really? It's, what is it that was so significant about this point in time to go through this process and really make it such a public thing? I kind of at times am annoyed by the fact that you have this kind of thing so public. You hear all these people, especially from the left, the government needs to stay out of our bedrooms and not, in, you know, put their be nosing around where they don't belong. But then this kind of thing is made public, and we're supposed to, you know, accept it, that it's that public, when it, on the other hand, like I said,
yeah,
you can't be in our bedrooms, right? Keep the
exactly. So it's basically only when it's useful. You know.
Right. And that was the whole point of Clinton, right? That was his personal life. It wasn't related to him as a president with regards to Monica Lewinsky. So no big deal.
Yeah, exactly. Except when it's to their benefit.
Exactly.
Except when it's promoting an agenda, or it adds to a political usefulness of some sort. And I think there's a reason why President Obama gives his shout-outs to this sort of thing, and I think he has a whole record of it. You know, anytime anything like this happens in the public eye, there he is. So,
and, you know, when you go back and look at the Olympic history books, was it a male or a female that won the decathlon? I guess it was a male, right?
Well, no, I mean, it was a male when it happened. I mean, yeah. I think that would be the point. Well, the real philosophical question is, all those tennis matches that Dr. Renee Richards won, was that a male or a female beating up on those little women?
Well, so
that would be the real question.
She had reservations about that, too, that women or the transgender shouldn't be in women's sports if it goes that way. So it is a thing that we want to avoid, but as Solomon so aptly says, we have to reason these things to really understand the truth of them. We'll be back right after these commercial breaks with more Solomon on Blast. Solomon on Blast. We're still on the air, so I guess we haven't created too much controversy at this point. If you want to call in, we'd love to hear from you. 750-7456. In this next story, it kind of follows along, and more of the, are we allowed to reason and understand what's going on in similar area. In this particular case, it has to do with the vote that occurred in Ireland with regards to whether or not they could redefine marriage as being between people of the same sex. And this particular article, written by a gentleman by the name of Michael Brown, he says, you need to know what really happened in Ireland. He says he almost never does it, but he felt it was important to share a letter with his readers so that the whole world could understand what really happened in Ireland, given that Ireland's a predominantly Catholic nation, but they voted decisively to redefine marriage. And he had posted on his Facebook page, what can we learn from the vote to redefine marriage in Ireland, which is, like I said, a traditionally Catholic country. He says, first of all, traditional Christian religion cannot stop the juggernaut of gay activism. Only a living, vibrant faith will have the energy and commitment and depth to stand firm. And he said, number two, sex scandals in the Catholic Church in the 90s robbed the church of its moral authority. How can the church speak to society about sexual morality when it has largely disqualified itself? Scandals like this take a long time to get over, and here in America we've been plagued by evangelical scandals as well, involving some of the well-known leaders. To that extent, we're deemed hypocritical to the extent we lack moral authority. And number three, Ireland was not ready for the massive influx of gay activist funding from America. Sadly, from President Obama down, America has been an aggressive force of normalizing homosexuality, and without American funding and vision, it's doubtful Ireland would have voted so strongly for such a radical change. Now, the part that he really wanted to present was that a woman from Ireland had written him a letter, an evangelical Christian there, and said that they really tried as a citizenship to oppose this campaign in their country, but she said that the news was really behind it. There was a lot of, like he had said, there was a lot of activism from the United States behind it. One particular American billionaire, Chuck Feeney, and he's the one that came up with the duty-free shops that you see in all of the airports, he alone contributed $24 million to this. The police were supporting it. The public police force was actually drafted to support the yes vote and to register college students to vote, and they passed out yes badges to these students. So it was really a concerted effort to make sure this happened, which is pretty surprising, but it begs the question, is if it's the will of the people, is it right?
Well, in a lot of ways, and he mentioned this in the article, and I think you have to really, consider this strongly, and this is not just a slam, but it's really probably the sociology of it. In many ways, this vote in Ireland was a referendum against Roman Catholic cultural hegemony. You know, There's not much of a Protestant
influence
to speak presence. Of. They're there, I'm sure,
This woman, obviously, one of them.
Like, they're everywhere, but, this is basically a country that's never had a reformation to it.
Oh,
and
true.
In the North, I wouldn't call that much of a reformation. Right. It's more of a revolution. They've fought over it in Belfast and all of that. But so I think that there's a lot more to this. He mentioned the sex scandals. I think to a point there is a serious indictment of sex abuse amongst the clergies. And basically they've had a monopoly over Ireland for so long. And I'm not blaming this all on the Roman Catholic Church. I'm simply saying the cultural factors there are really along those lines as much as any lines. I think what the gay agenda and lobby was able to do very successfully is to co-opt all the issues against the Catholic Church into their cause. And so they're able to draw this line and say this is the new versus the old, and they were very successful at doing that.
Yeah, and the numbers were actually
almost two-thirds,
yeah. 37.9% and was the no vote for being against this. So 68% roughly was for it, a little over two-thirds. But like the article states, this lady, she said it was very, very difficult to overcome the outside activism. She said in addition to the money being contributed, that when no vote campaign signs were posted in Dublin and other places, they were actually vandalized. And the public media are supposed to allow a 50-50 coverage for each side of the constitutional issue. And that's just like it is here in this country. They're supposed to have equal access for things, but it was blatantly ignored. She said the police force was involved and there wasn't anything done. She said even the paper ballot was biased, where the term marriage equality was what was put on the ballot.
Yeah.
So it was
which is a commentary on the vote.
Right. It's really about marriage equality. It's not about whether or not it's right or wrong and whether it's a homosexual issue or not. So part of the question is this the way we're going to see votes go across the world going forward?
Well, the European Union, you know, of course, is a factor in this as well. You know, the Republic of Ireland is a Euro country,
right?
And you know, the Northern Ireland is still part of the UK. So, I think all these issues are very much. I think they saw a great opportunity down there, and in Ireland, and they were able to converge on this and convince the millennials that this is the new versus the old, like I said a moment ago. And they were very, very effective at it. And there are probably, I think there's going to be tons of buyer's remorse from this, because as a society, when you embrace that to this level, it's you still have to contend with the natural factors of it all. It's not going to be what they thought it was going to be.
Right.
And I think a lot of these people really thought this is the way to go. You know, we're advancing, we're moving on, you know. And they're not looking at it so much in terms of people of the same sex lying down with each other with rings on their finger. They're looking at it as, you know, we're moving on in our way of thinking.
Our advance.
Yeah, we're advancing as a society and as a people into the 21st century boldly.
Right. And I'd have to say, when you look at those numbers, how many really does it affect in terms of the number of people that are going to be getting married in gay marriages in Ireland? I don't know what the population of Ireland is, but two-thirds of the people think it's okay. That, what, maybe 1% of the population at the most is going to take this approach, but it's a constitutional issue there, and it's been in vogue. So it's an interesting aspect that such a small percentage of the people are really what this whole referendum's about, but it's such a big issue across the country. So we'll come back with some more of Solomon on Blast right after these commercial breaks. All right, we're back with more Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Solomon says, Ecclesiastes 7:27. Here's what I've found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason. And along those those same lines that we've been continuing. There's an article that came out from Bloomberg. Says Americans vastly overestimate the size of the gay and lesbian population. It says same-sex marriage is one of the fastest moving social issues in U.S. history. But one thing that seems to be off kilter, according to the article, is Americans seem to have absolutely no idea how many of their fellow citizens are lesbian or gay. And that goes along with the fact that they're not reasoning through these things. In fact, the article says they think that 23% of Americans, or almost one in four, are gay or lesbian, when in reality, that's way off. The polling organization found recently that less than 4% self-identify. So a third of the people surveyed believe that lesbian gays made up more than 25% of the population, and only about 9% in the survey correctly stated that they thought the group was less than 5%. So again, we're looking at a situation where, based on the media hype and what gets presented in the news, it becomes way, way overblown in terms of how many people are we really talking about with these particular activities, in terms of like Ireland and the need for within the states to promote gay marriage within the states or same-sex marriage.
Well, I think human sexuality is a very complex subject, and it's really hard to track, you know, with that much detail. The way I view it, Doug, and we know a few people in life, and you've been around, and I've been around. I'd say, you know, in terms of people that you interact with, I'd say that maybe the LGBTQ footprint is 4%. You know, the brand, and that's what I call it, an image that they carefully craft and promote and politicize. But in terms of the same-sex relationship spectrum, I'd say that probably double or more than double that number.
So
in other words, the key phrase there is self-identify.
Yeah.
There's a major part of that that does not want the attention, and it's their business.
There's probably also a major part of those that want the attention that don't want that other percentage getting any attention because it wouldn't fit within their agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I mentioned the word brand that I like to use because there's a whole aspect of same-sex relationships that you never hear about, but are as real as any other relationship. In that, you know, you want to talk about prison relationships, you don't really hear much said about that. I don't know if they have an LGBTQ office, you know, at the federal prison, but I know that that's a major issue there. I know that, and there's a whole side of, and this is not, implicating anybody else, but in the criminal profile, they have an entire,
they profile for a reason,
section
basically. Yes.
Where criminals that are, that are very much consumed with same-sex crimes and that sort of thing, and it's interesting how they try to dismiss that. Well, that's really a straight guy trying to cope with, his innate hatred for his great-grandmother or something.
Right.
But, they try to put that in another category. But all of that is same-sex, right? Jeffrey Dahmer, anybody that's read his story knows that he was absolutely tormented with same-sex attractions and that all of his victims were fundamentally young men that he picked up for sex. Kill and eat. And
right.
That
right.
was his, but it wasn't young girls he was doing it. But they don't want to talk about that aspect, but it's a very real dimension of same-sex attraction. They used to profile this stuff all the time,
Right.
In fact, a very interesting story here. It's really there. I had to look it up because I had read an article and I really doubted it. Is that the Warren Commission that investigated the Kennedy assassination, one of their first theories was that if it was a group of homosexuals that were kind of acting out in some kind of, conspiracy fantasy. So, I mean, it's really fascinating, but that was really in the Warren Commission report. And so I'm just saying that it's a lot broader than people like to talk about, and you would talk about the LGBTQ footprint. Well, yeah, that's probably 4% or less. but there's a lot of other facets to it that they don't like to talk about.
Yeah, and a part of that is the violent, the domestic violence that gets involved with those same-sex marriages or relationships, just like there is in normal relationships. That seems to be pretty much hidden, because then that would go against that whole aspect that, well, we just want to get married because we're going to have a wonderful relationship. And then when things don't go well, then it exposes the fact that there's problems there. Not everything's the perfect picture that gets painted out in the public.
Right. And I think part of this, too, and getting back to putting this number back together with the whole Ireland thing and why a lot of straight people would support it, is because I think there's an assumption to this, that if gay and lesbian people are allowed to participate in a normal marriage relationship,
right,
that somehow that will normalize them, and that will, you know, allow them to somehow settle into, you know, that common experience that most people have, right?
In
a same-sex,
that's what we're led to believe.
Excuse me, in a heterosexual family, relationship, family,
right,
nuclear family. But, you know, I think there are other factors besides us socializing people that way. I think, you know, you just, without getting into all the details, let's just put it this way. Monogamy has never been
a premier,
great value,
yeah,
in the male gay community.
Exactly. All right, we'll be back right after these commercial messages with our One Greater Than Solomon segment. All right, we're back with more of Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. After all of that, I figure you really have to go back to a real man, real manliness, real reasoning that really, I think, has gotten us to where we're at in this, or gotten us to a point that we can be where we're at in this country. And as Dave had mentioned on the prior show, that, you know, it is, today is D-Day, the invasion of Normandy. And so as part of this, I hadn't really thought about it when I came up with this. I thought I'd give a little, read a little bit about Major Dick Winters. He was the commander of Easy Company, 82nd Airborne, part of the, what, if you've ever seen it, the Band of Brothers miniseries. He's portrayed in there. And to me, he's one of those, what I would say is an introspective and iron-willed man, that is really what stops the tide of disaster when it comes into the world. And that's really what was going on back there in World War II. And in this article, it says Major Dick Winters, like I said, commander of Easy Company, he was cut from a different cloth than many of the military officers, either then or now. He was sober, disciplined, quiet, reflective, cool, and resolute in many ways. He lived a life apart from his men, yet the strength and wisdom he gained from his retreats from the world enabled him to lead his troops through a D-Day attack on German artillery, an assault on the French town of Carentin, a bayonet charge in Holland, the cold of Bastogne, and finally to Hitler's eagle's nest in the Bavarian Alps. And he did it all before he was 24 years old, and had just recently gotten out of college when he went in. In his memoirs, he says that it was his earnest hope that his remembrances and reflections will help each reader find a personal peace and solitude in a turbulent world, in a time of ceaseless noise and distraction. And like I said, the lack of reasoning, his message and examples have never been more needed than now. He was stationed in France before the, or in England before the actual invasion in France. And in there, he was quartered with a family called the name of the Barneses. They, while he was there, he had attended a church service, and it turned out they were the ones who were responsible for that church. The husband was the pastor there, and his wife would play the piano. And when they went around that town asking for people to quarter, they agreed that they would quarter people as long as he was the one that got to be part of their household. So they adopted him as their own son, provided him with a refuge to be able to work on his training and his planning for the invasion of D-Day, the tactical manuals and that kind of thing. And in preparing to lead men in combat, he felt his time to be extremely precious and thus devoted as much of it as possible to becoming totally proficient in tactics and technology and developing his own personal perspective on command. He says, the typical evening at their house began with Mrs. Barnes knocking on his door before 9 and saying, Lieutenant Winters, would you like to come down and listen to the news and have a spot of tea? Sitting around the smoldering chunk of peat in the fireplace, we listened to the BBC. Afterwards, everybody would gather around the table and Mr. Barnes would read a passage from the Bible. Then he would say a prayer, after which Mrs. Barnes would serve tea and biscuits, and around 10 they would head off to bed. He says his association with the family was one of the most enjoyable experiences in his life. And he says, they prepared me mentally for the task that lay ahead. I had observed their personal suffering because they had lost their son in the war, and he experienced similar feelings when he lost some of his men in Normandy and the subsequent campaigns. By giving me time to reflect and study my manuals during the 9 months prior to the invasion, the Barnes helped me develop my own personality and hone my leadership skills. He believed that the cornerstone of character was honesty, and from there you worked to develop a moral compass that was guided by the virtues of courage, fairness, consistency, selflessness, and respect for your fellow man. For Winters, keeping his personal honor code was a matter of integrity and self-respect. He says, for Major Winters, his spirit-maintaining ritual was church attendance. Very few soldiers attended religious services while overseas, even in the anxious days leading up to the Normandy invasion. But for Winters, going to church became the bedrock of his character, and he only missed 3 services in the 9 months he lived there in England. As he explained to his pen pal, the way I feel about it, it's a very special privilege to be able to go at all, and I don't want to miss a chance. And he said, really, when it came down to it, it was his prayer life that supported him in those days going into Normandy and leading his men. And to the point where if he hadn't had that, he didn't think he would have made it through. So just a little tribute to Major Dick Winters on this D-Day. And until next week, think wisely.